It is a State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here as we get acquainted with the policy priorities of first-term Democratic Representative Clinton Anderson of Beloit. His constituents span portions of Greene and Rock counties in the 45th Assembly District. You've aligned to a lawmaker. Join in by calling with questions you have, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Representative Clinton Anderson, welcome to the Ideas Network.
I appreciate being here. Thank you.
Legislators across the state, they're holding listening sessions. You've been a part of this spring to gather the input on the next two-year state budget. What are you learning from these budget conversations?
We held three of them with myself and Senator Spreitzer, who's my state senator, and we heard a lot of common themes, whether it was in Beloit, whether it was in Broadhead, whether it was in Evansville. We heard people wanting to make sure that we have proper school funding. Shared revenue was a conversation. We had a lot of local elected officials who attended, and a lot of conversations around mental health and infrastructure. So didn't matter where exactly we were, there was a common theme across the board. And I think even with the folks that are doing the Joint Finance Committee listening sessions are probably hearing about the same thing too. And it's a good indicator that those are probably the topics we should be focusing on in the budget.
Are the things you're hearing new, or do they track with what you have heard in the past as Beloit City Council President?
They're pretty close. I mean, shared revenues are obviously been a conversation that we've had over my 6 years when I was on the council. With it remaining flat for over a decade, it's really tough to keep up with inflation, keep up with rising costs, and also it's really difficult to expand services and expand opportunities in your community when you have no more new money. That's one of the main streams of revenue that the city of Beloit has and mainstream revenue that most communities have as well.
Governor Evers is calling for dedicating 20% of the state sales taxes to fund local governments in the next budget. Prior to being elected to the Assembly, you, as I mentioned, were on the Beloit City Council. How would additional state funding be used in communities like Beloit?
There's a lot of opportunities, and that's what's great about the shared revenue funds is that the communities are able to make the best decisions for themselves. As I said before, I took this office, the needs of Evansville are different from Beloit, and they're different from Broadhead, different from Orchardville, and even places like Monticello and Albany. So letting those municipalities have the authority to do what's best for them, because each community has unique needs. So I think every community is going to welcome extra funding to address the topics that are of concern for them, whether it's roads, whether it's staffing. It's just great that they can have a chance to address those unique needs for themselves.
Do you think there are different unique needs and perspectives when residents live on or near the state line?
Somewhat. I mean, somewhat. I don't think it's drastically different. I mean, we have our tourism industry is a little different than some other places because people might just stop off the highway when they come into Wisconsin. I know when I travel, when I get into a new state, that's usually when I like to pull over and get some gas or go get something to eat. So that'd be the only major difference I would notice.
Should local governments have fewer limits on like hiking sales taxes or property taxes? What impacts do you see there?
Well, in the governor's proposal, he is allowing municipalities that have a population of 30,000 or more to implement a 0.5% municipal sales tax. This could provide some relief for people that are really worried about paying more property taxes, and it's another stream of revenue that right now the municipalities, with the exception of Milwaukee, have. Our counties are able to do it, and I believe almost all the counties in the state of Wisconsin have implemented that sales tax. So giving that as another tool in a toolbox for local government is really important. So I hope that we get that through in the budget.
We're exploring the priorities of a first-term state legislator, Democratic Representative Clinton Anderson of Beloit. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Looking at the sales and property taxes, there's been the concern over net new construction calculated by the state. And a municipality is allowed to increase its levy over the amount it levied during the prior year by the percentage increase in net new construction. Do you find that there is constraint in that, or what, do you have any issues with that?
I do have a lot of concerns with it. I know that in Beloit, we're very lucky that we've had a lot of new development, which is the only thing that's kept us from making some really tough decisions financially. There's a lot of communities, for example, Evansville and Albany. I know that I've talked to folks there, and they don't have any opportunities to really expand and do a lot of net new construction. So they're really constrained by these levy limits. So doing it based on net new construction is really harmful for communities that are landlocked or have no opportunity to build on new property.
What do you think is the alternative?
I think one is addressing the amount of shared revenue. I think that is step one. And then allowing other streams of revenue, having them be only allowed to increase levy based on net new construction is really difficult and challenging. So giving them more streams of revenue and more opportunities to have money and flexibility is really important. So that's really where we need to start.
Aside from the shared revenue and state funding streams, what are other pressing issues for local governments here in Wisconsin and other issues you have your eye on?
I think just the stuff that's in the budget, I think the funding is the big top priority, whether it's in cities or towns, which I think folks might have heard on their most recent break here on WPR was talking about the funding for road construction in rural communities. A lot of them are unable to receive grant funding based on the side of the definition of a bridge. So it has to be over, I think 6 feet or 20 feet. There is a lot of structures that aren't big enough to qualify for grants. So funding for an inventory is really important so we can see what we need to look at, making sure we can get them consistent funding versus one-time funding. When I was at a district meeting for the Towns Association, a lot of them said, well, we prefer to have stable funding. We'll take grant funding, but they want stability just like everybody else would, whether it's in our personal lives or when it comes to a business or government. We want consistency and making competitive grants that are very limited. And definitely there's a higher demand than there is for the amount of money we're giving. So tackling the road funding for townships is also another thing we need to be doing.
I want to turn to farmland and land preservation. You're supporting expanding eligibility for farmland preservation programs and the tax credits that go with them. Why are more financial incentives needed to preserve farmland?
Well, first off, we did just pass that in the assembly on a voice vote. So that was really, really exciting to see. I'm on the ag committee and it passed unanimously out of that committee as well. The incentives basically were just to get more people to stay in it. We heard that folks weren't interested in the length of the commitment. It was 15 years. This bill lowered it to 10 years that they'd be in the farmland preservation program. It also increased the dollar amount per acre to also further incentivize. And on top of that, we also indexed it to inflation so that we don't have to keep coming back and having this conversation, because we want to make sure that as many farmers are participating as possible. We know that once that agricultural land is developed, the odds of becoming farmland are almost none. So anything we can do to incentivize farmers to keep that land in use is really important. And farmland preservation program does help us do that.
How are farmers doing in your district? Is farmland being swallowed up and redeveloped in your district, or do you see farmers struggling?
I think you see this everywhere. You see a lot of farmers getting out of it. You see a lot less ag land than we did 10 years ago. This is just another tool for them to use to incentivize them to keep that farmland in use. It's really important that we do that and make sure that it's also in good quality health for years to come, so that when the next generation of farmers are starting to get involved, that they have no issues with soil and water quality.
Democratic Representative Clinton Anderson of Beloit with us discussing policy priorities in his first term in the legislature. Call in about issues you want to cover, questions you have for a state lawmaker, 800-642-1234. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Democratic Representative Clinton Anderson of Beloit in a South Central district along the Illinois border. Previously served as the Beloit City Council President before being sworn into the Assembly in January. Call in with questions, concerns, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You are a member of the Young Elected Officials Network, that organization for progressives elected officials under age 35. How are you urging Democrats in Wisconsin to become more progressive?
Well, I think we have a very diverse caucus, so it's more just having conversations. It's, I like to think of things as a long game. I remember years ago when you had someone like Senator Bernie Sanders saying $15 minimum wage, and it was seen as this crazy idea that why would we do that? Now that's the common phrase that everybody uses when they're trying to convince people to get involved in the workforce, or like, well, we pay $15 an hour. So it's about just having those repeated conversations and making a case for why things need to be done a certain way. And being involved in that network has been very helpful to hear stories from other elected officials that are very inspiring.
Do you think progressive Democrats are in alignment with the caucus as a whole in our state legislature, or is there some divergence in the party?
I mean, I wouldn't say there's divergence. I mean, I think there's differing opinions, but I don't think we've seen such a wild disagreement that we've had any difficulties having a conversation. Like I said, the Democratic Party is a big tent party. And I think you really do see that in our caucus, but I think the dialogue's been very healthy.
Do you see room for Democratic socialists in the caucus?
Well, we have two socialists in the caucus now, and I think it's just a testament to how welcoming this caucus is, that we have people of various different views. And it's just, like I said, testament to the Democratic Party as a whole. We're very accepting.
Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is in Delafield. Jeff, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Yes, good morning. I think a tie can be made to the issue of farmland preservation and the lack of shared revenue for municipalities. One of the reasons that farmland is converted to development is because of the lack of shared revenue, and it forces the municipality to greenlight more and more development to pay for it, you know, the cost of its government. So it's kind of counterintuitive to the idea of farmland preservation. And the other comment I have is in regards to landowners who want to preserve native landscapes, grasslands, plant trees, that sort of thing. They're severely penalized as opposed to if they were to grow row crops. As soon as you plant a tree or convert it to native grassland, your taxes are going to go up significantly. So that's also a real problem. Thank you.
Jeff, thank you for sharing these insights. Democratic Representative Clinton Anderson, what do you hear there in the tensions between farmland preservation and shared revenue first?
Well, I know that caller can't say it, but I'm smiling when he made that connection because I think it's such a valid point. There is incentive to develop property when you have nothing else to do. So when there is no extra revenue coming in, you do everything you can, even if that means giving up farmland. So I really appreciate that call. That actually that was a really nice, good tie-in. I thought that was a good connection to make.
To qualify for the benefits of the farmland preservation programs, landowners must meet these conservation standards for soil and water. Jeff bringing up native landscapes. Are the conservation standards strict enough? Do they go far enough?
I think they're fair. And some of it, too, is that we want to make sure farmers are incentivized. And the way I've seen a lot of positive change, especially during my short tenure here, is that when you get farmers to buy in, they'll convince other farmers to get involved. And I think immediately of watershed protection groups. We have a really great watershed protection groups in both Rock and Green counties. It's farmers talking about strategies they're using, whether it's no-till, whether it's cover crops, and talking about soil health as a whole. So when you get farmers in a room, you get them to buy in, that's when you're going to see this really take off. So I think right now our conservation efforts are good. I think letting farmers buy in is really the right step. And I think you're seeing the benefits of it already.
We're going to turn now to marijuana. Governor Evers' budget includes a proposal to legalize recreational marijuana in the state. Across the border in South Beloit is a marijuana dispensary. How is nearby access to marijuana affecting the communities that you represent along the border?
Well, I did a little experiment. I went and went to the parking lot and talked to a manager at Sunnyside Dispensary there in South Beloit. And I'll tell you, I think I only saw one or two Illinois license plates. Every single vehicle was a Wisconsin plate. And in fact, the manager thanked me for having marijuana still be illegal because he said we're getting a lot of money because of it. So we're really behind the eight ball in this. I think the whole state is suffering, not just the state line area, from this being legal in Michigan and in Illinois. We're not just losing tax dollars, we're losing economic opportunities. These are new businesses. These are better jobs. These are things that bring people to visit the state. So it's not just a state line issue. It's a Wisconsin issue.
Recently, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said that the GOP is working to introduce a plan for legalizing medical cannabis by this fall. How would legalizing medical marijuana affect people where you live?
Well, once again, it's not just a localized issue, it's a state issue. I know that medicinal marijuana has been proven to help people with a lot of underlying health issues. So it's a step in the right direction. Obviously, I think myself and many other people in my caucus would agree that going full legalization is the best route. I mean, we had a series of referenda across the state about legalization, and obviously medicinal was very, very popular, but recreational as well was well over 50-60% of the vote for those that participated. So medicinal is a step in the right direction. It does have a lot of benefits. I'm looking forward to seeing that proposal.
What do you think is holding back your colleagues across the aisle on recreational marijuana?
I think some of it could just be not knowing or concerns with some of the talking points I might have seen. I don't know what else would hold them back, honestly, because I think that if you're looking at the economics of it, it's great. If you look at we're also going to have less people that'll be incarcerated because of small amounts of marijuana, which will also save us money. It's a money generator, and it's also been proven not to be as recklessly dangerous as they like to reference all the time. I know they like to use Colorado as this big, scary place, but I think Colorado's really seen an economic boom since they legalized about 6 years ago.
We're looking at the priorities of Democratic Representative Clinton Anderson of Beloit, first-term state lawmaker. You can join in with your questions and concerns at 800-642-1234. We heard from Marcus in Milwaukee called in, and Marcus notes that they see a lot of vape cartridges and batteries littering the ground, and they're wondering what cities or the legislature could do to address this type of e-waste that Marcus is seeing.
I'm not sure, and I mean, we don't know what was in those cartridges, but I think that's going to be a lot of municipalities taking onus on that. I know that if we had that going on in my community in Beloit, we would start addressing need locally first. I think not everything is a state lawmaker solution. Sometimes it's a local solution.
The Beloit Police Department is reporting more people are dying from drug overdoses this year compared to last year. What efforts in the Capitol are priorities for reducing drug overdoses?
Well, one bill that's out is requiring school districts to have Narcan in buildings. I think that's a good step for us to really address the need. I've got Narcan with me. That is just a small thing we can do to reduce the people that die from overdoses. It's also education and letting people know that whatever people's opinions of someone who's dealing with addiction are, it could be anybody. It doesn't have to be someone who looks like they're just out in the streets. It could be your coworkers. It could be your family members. It could be a teacher. It could be anybody. So us really reducing the stigma is also going to be a step that is beyond the Capitol, but I think it's something that we should all be acknowledging and recognizing.
When you say you have Narcan with you, do you carry it like in your car?
Yes. Now, when it gets to certain temperatures, obviously you need to make sure you're being safe with it because you want it to not get too cold because that can also affect it. But I do have it. We have a lot of great agencies in this area that give it out for free. It's a nasal spray, which I do recommend people getting. It's really simple, and if somebody isn't having an overdose and you use it on them, it's not going to do any harm either. So it's just another thing that we should all be carrying with us and being mindful of.
Representative Clinton Anderson, thank you for joining us.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Clinton Anderson represents the 45th Assembly District, which includes portions of Greene and Rock County. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We check in with the Office of School Safety now, examining its resources, its anti-violence work as the state budget process is underway. The office was created with bipartisan support in 2018 after the Parkland, Florida shooting. Call in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Trish Kilpin is Executive Director of the Office of School Safety within the Wisconsin Department of Justice. Trish, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me and for your interest in school safety here in Wisconsin.
Yes, this Office of School Safety has been funded by federal dollars from the American Recovery Plan Act, that funding set to expire later this year. Why should the state legislature continue funding the office?
The Office of School Safety was originally created to provide grants to schools and to become a repository for 5 documents for every school that document their school safety work. The Office of School Safety has embraced providing model practices to all of our schools here in Wisconsin. And while we know that we have to respond appropriately to school safety issues, we know too that prevention is where the work is at. We provide training and best practices to schools across the state, to every school, and we do that for free. We're able to engage in some of the practices that we know work. Since I've been on last time, there have been more school violent incidents, more school shootings. We experienced several since I was on last June. While we prioritize responding appropriately to those tragedies, and in fact, the Office of School Safety has created 12 critical incident response teams across the state in order to provide a right-sized response when there's a crisis in a school, we know that prevention is where it's at. And while we know that school safety violent incidents like the shootings that have happened across our nation can have people feeling pretty overwhelmed and helpless, we instead bring to schools some hope that if they engage in model practices that we can teach them and provide them resources to conduct, that they are more likely to prevent violence in their schools.
Looking at funding, Attorney General Josh Call requested $2.2 million for the office in the next budget cycle. Governor Evers reduced that to about $1 million in his proposal. How would that funding be used?
The funding request that has been made by the Department of Justice is for us to continue our operations. While many people might not realize all the work that we do with our small team, we run Speak Up, Speak Out Wisconsin. That is a tip reporting line where anyone can get support for youth. Since it was launched in September of 2020, it has received over 6,700 tips documenting concerns, telling us that youth need support and assistance and intervention. Though positions that are provided in the governor's budget are a great start, and we're appreciative of having conversations about stable funding for our office, but we are striving for the $2.2 million, which includes 16 positions, 10 of which are to staff the 24/7 call center, Speak Up, Speak Out Wisconsin. And so that the funding request is really just to continue our operations, not even to grow our office, providing threat assessment assistance, providing courses, providing classes, providing critical incident response teams, providing grant opportunities to schools, all of the things that we do every day. So the it's a great start, what's in the governor's budget, but we'd have to do some pretty intensive strategic planning, and we would not be able to continue as we are without the full funding.
Can you talk a little bit further about Speak Up, Speak Out Resource Center and this tip line, hotline? You mentioned the thousands of tips that have come in. How often are authorities acting on tips that the center receives?
We receive tips every day. So the tips coalesce around different categories. So there's different topics that we respond to. Every tip that we received is delivered to the school. So every tip that a student lets us know that they're being harassed, they're being bullied, they're being maltreated, they are a victim of abuse, they have a concern that a peer might have a gun or a weapon or is planning a school attack, every tip gets delivered to the school, and the school responds by providing interventions and providing what is necessary to prevent violence and give students the support that they need and deserve. Some of those tips also go to law enforcement. So when it's a life safety matter, when a crime has been committed, when there is a potential that someone is in danger, we receive many tips from students telling us that their friend has posted that they have plans to kill themselves. We are able to provide those interventions and prevent tragedy.
Are these tips mostly coming in from students?
Yes, most of our tips come from students. We also, though, receive a fair amount of requests through our Speak Up, Speak Out Center from adults, from school staff, from administrators, from local law enforcement, asking us for support and assistance for something that they're encountering. We provide case consultation for threat assessment. We provide critical incident response when a student has had a tragedy in a school, such as when a student dies that attends a school. Hmm. We help that school to respond appropriately in order to help the students recover. So some of our tips come from the adults. Most of our tips come from our students.
Since launching it, have you seen any trend lines? Like, for instance, when there is just a tragic school shooting somewhere else in the country, or, you know, even in Wisconsin, do you see different peaks and valleys with this tip line?
We have. We have seen our trend line is really showing us tremendous growth. So as we show our students and staff that we're an effective and efficient resource for their concerns, We are having an increase in tips. From February last year to February this year, there was 163% increase in tips. So we are increasing significantly. Our largest tip, our most frequent tip, is bullying, student bullying and harassment. And we're really pleased with that opportunity to intervene early when somebody is struggling, because we know often in acts of school violence, it starts with an upset or a grievance, and we prefer to solve things at an early stage.
We're talking with the director of Wisconsin's Office of School Safety, which is located within the State Justice Department. You can join in with your questions, your concerns at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. When you talk about bullying, and that's, it seems like our sole focus has been to figure out lockdowns, to figure out these tragic incidents when someone is coming into the building armed. Are there resources within your office that we might not be thinking about that your office is providing?
Absolutely. Some of that best practice school safety guidance is to help schools make decisions that will be effective if they were to encounter something like a school safety threat. So schools are required to submit to us their blueprints, their maps, their school safety plan, which is like their emergency operation plan, their school safety assessment, which should guide their plan, the documentation of their school safety drills and their school safety training. And when they do that, we are able to provide them with some feedback and best practice guidance. For example, we know that school safety drills are a critical piece to this equation. People have to be ready to respond appropriately if there was a crisis in a school. But we also know that we must do them in ways that do not produce any trauma. So we advocate for no drama, no trauma drills. We provide training on that and support for schools so they can make the decisions that are best for their students.
There is that sentiment, especially among young people, that these drills aren't helping, that they're not solving, that they're adding trauma to students' lives. How do you respond to that feedback?
Drills are supposed to increase muscle memory. That is a goal of a school safety drill. They can be done in a way that does that without increasing anxiety. So always telling students when a drill is about to occur, informing the community that there will be a drill, providing opportunities for feedback, and not using sensory, so not using sounds of violence, not invoking fear. We don't light the garbage can on fire in order to have a fire drill. And we don't need to have the sounds of bullets or tragedy or harm to help our students have that muscle memory. And that is the goal of a drill. So a very calm, planned, predictable drill, it has not been shown to increase trauma. But we have to do that in a very specified way.
You mentioned building maps. And I think the last time we talked, there were these a lot of effort to upgrade and improve the types of school blueprint building maps being kept by the Justice Department and local law enforcement. How is that project going?
It's really, we've seen such a use of the grant. The grant is Act 109, provided funds for schools to be reimbursed for creating digital maps. And all of those funds were pretty quickly depleted, and we found we had a waiting list. So we had a very small amount of monies left from our original $100 million in grants, some funds that we were able to put into that project. And we now have, it's open again, and schools can apply. Schools are finding great value in these maps, not just in creation of the maps, but in their conversations with law enforcement, in their ongoing communications. And it's we're very excited about the results that we've seen with this grant opportunity that was a commitment from the legislature.
Why does the making these maps digital matter? What impact does it have?
It's a much more efficient and effective way for law enforcement or first responders to know exactly what is needed at a school, where the location that they should be responding to, what door they should use. It's kind of like having a digital battleship kind of map. And if there's an incident, not just a school violence incident, but it also could be like somebody is in need of medical assistance. And let's say they're by the school pool. How does the emergency responders get there most efficiently. Mm. So it's really decreasing that confusion with unfamiliar responders and even those who respond often just to what exactly the crisis is and how to be most effective.
Trish Kilpin leads the Office of School Safety as we look at its funding picture, its resources housed within the State Justice Department, working on programs for schools designed to keep kids safe. Call in with questions and thoughts, 800-642-1234. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report in the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We get briefed on the funding priorities of the State Office of School Safety as the biennial budget process is underway. This is the office that created the Speak Up, Speak Out Resource Center, that one-stop threat reporting 24-hour tip line. Trish Kilpin is director of the Office of School Safety. Let's take a call now. Martha in Menominee. Martha, hi. What's on your mind?
Yeah, it seems that this is just going on and on and on, and not much is being done about the, you know, gun violence in the schools. My question is, what can be done as far as these traumas? Kids are going to school and they're facing trauma every day. just to go to school, you know, active shooter drills and all these threats of, you know, these guns in schools and the shootings. Why can't the principals, the administrators get together with the teachers and just do something to say, we're not going to do this anymore until the legislature, the people in the legislatures, grow some cojones and stand up to the gun lobby?
So,
you know, the legislature.
Martha, I'm going to toss us back to Trish Kilpin here. Trish, you know, Martha really concerned that it really stems from lawmaking here and access to guns.
Martha, thank you for recognizing the way that our students are being impacted by the ongoing crisis that's created when school violent events happen. I do appreciate that. You are correct that our children are being impacted by these incidents. We must lean into the things that we know work at schools. When somebody comes to school and they commit an act of violence, it could be someone outside of the school community. Maybe they have a previous relationship with the school community, as we saw in Nashville. And that is when we utilize practices such as hardening the school and creating locked entrances and those types of things. But we know that oftentimes an act of school violence occurs by somebody who attends that school. And so those things don't tend to work. What we know do work is being able to get that tip reporting information out to students so they can report early. 81% of the time when there's been an act of school violence, a peer knew about it. Somebody knew that their peer was planning an act of school violence. So providing things like SUSO, promoting SUSO, making sure that our community, our parents, everyone is knowledgeable about SUSO, helps us to meet that goal to prevent violence by becoming aware and intervening early. The second practice that we know works with preventing school violence is taken from the Secret Service. So it's adapted from their process of protecting public officials. And that is the practice of behavioral threat assessment and management. And with that, our office trains people across the state. We've trained thousands of law enforcement and school administrators and school pupil service mental health folks and teachers about how to determine when a student who made a threat, if they truly pose a threat, and exactly how to intervene and make sure that violence doesn't happen.
Let's bring in Derek now in Appleton. Derek, hi.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
Sure, go ahead.
Well, first of all, I just wanted to say that I'm a huge fan of the Office of School Safety and DOJ. It's incredible to me that we even talk about having enough money to fund your department. It should be double that. So I'm very thankful for what Office of School Safety does for our state and our kids. The question I have is how close are we to the Office of School Safety approving blueprints of new buildings being built for education in our state? I could see in the future that retrofits are going to cost millions of dollars, because eventually I believe we're going to get there to where you can't just build a school made of glass and open concept because of response protocols for safety. How close are we to actually implement at your level, at the state level, approval for blueprints for buildings like some of the other states in the country has done?
Well, that's interesting, Derek. Thank you for bringing that. Trish.
Derek, thank you for your support of our office. We are appreciative. This is not something that I know about in terms of the approval of those blueprints. I do know that our office has school safety consultants that will work with schools as they're making plans for their emergency operations. And we do provide those funds for grants. I am hoping that there will be universal support, bipartisan support for what we know works for schools. And I'd love to know more about that, about how to make sure that our schools are built in ways that we that are safe for students. And we have that, what we call SEPTED, which is environmental design to prevent violence.
Time is something, too, that you must really take a look at here, that you have to respond really quickly in an office. And, you know, state government perhaps on a whole, might not move that fast when it comes to different projects or programs or reacting to something that is happening right then. What about time and how your office has to respond?
It is critical that we have our 24/7 call center. We receive calls in the middle of the night from communities who have just experienced a trauma, from schools who are victims of anonymous threats, swatting incidents, and we're able to, at all hours of the day and nights, weekends, holidays, provide them with the interventions that they need. You are correct that we can't have a time barrier to giving our students and our school staff what they need in order to overcome any kind of threat for school safety. And so while we understand that things have to go through the legislature, we are always engaging in best practices and trying to bring schools what they need as efficiently and quickly as possible.
We're in conversation with the head of Wisconsin's Office of School Safety, which is located within the Department of Justice, Trish Kilpin here. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jeff in Appleton. Good morning, Jeff. Go ahead.
Good morning. I agree with the guest that bullying and some of this bad student behavior is really at the root of things that escalate to some real tragedies. But my question then is, if these students are not, well, in terms of efficiency, speaking to local administrators and teachers would be the most efficient. If these students are feeling it necessary to call a state agency, is that not an either complete failure to address it on the local level, or at the best, I guess, would be a complete vote of no confidence on these local administrators to deal with the issues in their local schools? So is there a plan to work with the local school administrators, teachers, to learn how to deal with this? And
at a local level? Jeff, yes, and I'm going to have Trish respond, short on time. Go ahead, Trish.
You are correct. We need to provide access to support in every school. So having trusted adults that handle things effectively and efficiently when students have a concern. Sometimes there are barriers to doing that. Students worry about retaliation. They worry about being exposed. And so this provides another layer of support. In no way should we be replacing the need for schools to have build that trust with their students and having students come to them when they have a concern. We'd like to promote help seeking versus secrecy in these types of situations.
Trish, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. And thank you for your support of the Office of School Safety.
Trish Kilpin has been the director of the Wisconsin Department of Justice's Office of School Safety since February of last year. It is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.